Back in 2021, the United States government ran this, honestly, this unprecedented real-world experiment.
Oh, right, the child tax credit expansion.
Exactly. They essentially just started mailing checks to parents, like no strings attached, no bureaucratic hoops to jump through, just direct cash.
Which is pretty rare for federal policy.
Super rare. And the result was immediate. I mean, in just a few months, child poverty dropped to a record low of 5.2%.
Wow.
Yeah. It turns out the oldest, most direct cure for poverty, just giving people money, actually works. But of course, that policy also sparked this enormous debate.
Oh, absolutely. A huge debate about the nature of work, about dependency, and really the fundamental role of the state.
Right. And that is exactly what we're getting into today. Welcome to the deep dive.
It's a debate that's been raging for centuries, honestly. And today, we are attempting to map out that whole diagnostic landscape.
So whether you are a policymaker, drafting legislation, or maybe you're just someone trying to navigate this turbulent modern economy.
Or you're just insanely curious about how the world works.
Yes, exactly. Our mission today is to decode how societies actually fight poverty and pursue global economic justice.
And to do that, we are analyzing a colossal variety of perspectives today. I mean, we are talking 18th century philosophical pamphlets.
All the way to World Bank climate analyses. We've got think tank evaluations on housing, United Nations reports, the works.
Yeah, it's a huge stack of sources.
It is, and we should be incredibly clear right up front. The perspectives we're unpacking span the entire political spectrum.
Right, from progressive proposals for wealth redistribution.
Right alongside conservative free market critiques of government intervention. Our goal here isn't to take a side, or tell you what to think.
We're just impartially mapping out the plumbing of these ideas so you, the listener, can form your own conclusions.
Because before we can understand today's hyper-specific debates over tax credits or minimum wages, we need to look at how the very concept of poverty shifted.
Yeah, that historical context is everything. Because for a huge portion of human history, poverty was just viewed as an unavoidable tragedy.
Just a fact of nature.
Exactly. Or worse, a moral failing. And the only mechanism to address it back then was private charity.
Right. But then you see this distinct pivot where poverty starts being viewed as a structural problem.
Yeah.
It's like the paradigm shifted from treating poverty as a chronic, incurable condition that we just manage with charity.
To viewing it as a structural bug in the system.
Exactly. A bug that requires a public policy patch or like a total rewrite.
And the earliest blueprint for that patch actually comes from way back in 1797.
Thomas Paine,
It's
right?
Thomas Paine's pamphlet, Agrarian Justice. Paine argued that private ownership of land inherently created inequality.
Because the earth was originally a common human inheritance.
Right. So when land was enclosed and privatized, he argued it stripped people of their natural ability to sustain themselves.
And his solution is just fascinating because of how modern it sounds today.
It really does. He didn't suggest abolishing private property or anything like that. Instead, he proposed a national fund.
Financed by an inheritance tax on landowners.
Exactly. And that fund would pay a lump sum to young adults starting out, plus a regular pension for older citizens.
It's essentially an 18th century prototype for social insurance and like a universal basic income.
He was arguing that this wasn't charity, it was a right. It was compensation for the loss of that natural inheritance.
And that philosophical leap moving from charity to economic right really sets the stage for the 20th century.
Oh, definitely. You see it clearly in the 1930s and 40s.
With Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal.
Yeah. FDR fundamentally argued that political freedom is meaningless without economic security.
I think he framed it perfectly in his 1944 Second Bill of Rights speech. He famously described seeing one-third of a nation ill-housed, ill-clad, ill-nourished.
The state was basically taking on the role of guarantor for basic human needs.
That's true, but we have to look at the mechanics of how that actually played out.
Right, the implementation is where it gets messy.
Yeah.
Look at the policy result of that era, particularly the GI Bill after World War II.
Oh, yeah. It was an absolute engine for upward mobility.
It provided government-backed mortgages, tuition payments to millions of veterans. I mean, it literally built the American middle class.
However, the implementation was deeply flawed.
Deeply, because the benefits were largely administered at the local level.
Right, which meant redlining and discriminatory practices systematically excluded Black Americans from this incredible wealth-generating machine.
It's a stark reminder that a structural fix can also structurally enforce inequality if you're not careful.
Which brings a whole new context to the 1960s. You have Lyndon B. Johnson's 1964 War on Poverty,
aiming to attack the root causes with programs like Medicare, Medicaid, and Head Start.
But at the exact same time, you have Martin Luther King Jr.'s Poor People's Campaign in 1967 and 68.
And King wasn't just asking for temporary relief or incremental programs. No, he framed poverty as a national moral failure. He demanded the absolute abolition of poverty through guaranteed income and jobs.
But we cannot ignore the counterargument that coalesced at that exact moment in history.
Reagan.
Yes. Ronald Reagan's 1964 A Time for Choosing speech, it really laid out the conservative pushback that would define the next several decades.
He argued that federal economic intervention is inherently inefficient
and an infringement on individual freedom. The argument there is that high taxes and heavy regulation stifle the economic growth that actually lifts people out of poverty.
Right, that it creates a cycle of government dependency instead.
Exactly. And that tension between government intervention as a moral necessity and government intervention as a bureaucratic overreach, that's the foundation of everything we're looking at today.
And honestly, there is no better place to see the mechanics of that tension play out than housing.
Housing is the crux of it.
Because you cannot fix poverty if a family doesn't have a stable roof over their heads. It is the absolute bedrock of stability.
Just think about your own zip code for a second. The Urban Institute emphasizes what they call the neighborhood effect.
Yeah, where you live isn't just about the physical building.
No, your address dictates the tax base that funds your child's local school. It dictates your access to reliable public transit, your proximity to high-paying jobs.
The literal street you live on is one of the greatest statistical predictors of whether your kids will end up in a higher tax bracket than you.
It's staggering. And the McKinsey Institute report we're analyzing focuses heavily on this.
They explicitly link the housing affordability crisis to economic mobility, particularly for Black families.
They argue that expanding access to stable, affordable housing is the primary lever for closing racial wealth gaps.
But how do we actually do that? Because the consensus seems to be that we have a severe supply shortage.
Right. We simply need to build more housing.
But building takes years. A family facing eviction today cannot wait for a new apartment complex to be finished in 2029.
Which is exactly why organizations like the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities advocate for a two-pronged approach.
Okay, so supply is the long-term fix.
But rental assistance is the immediate intervention. Because the mechanism of an eviction is just a cascading trauma.
Yeah, when a family loses their home, they often lose their belongings. The kids are pulled out of their school.
And maintaining a steady job becomes nearly impossible when you don't know where you're sleeping. Keeping a family in their home prevents that freefall.
Okay, I have a specific question here based on our sources. If the consensus is that we need both supply and assistance, and the data is so clear that keeping people housed prevents all these downstream societal costs like emergency room visits and policing,
right,
then why is rental assistance consistently the first thing on the chopping block? Like, we see those proposed HUD rules in our sources that actively seek to cut this funding, leaving hundreds of thousands without stable housing. What is the economic logic there?
Well, it goes right back to that 1960s philosophical divide. Critics of expanding rental assistance argue that injecting government subsidies into a market with a constrained supply simply inflates demand.
Oh, I see. So if a landlord knows a tenant has a guaranteed government voucher,
they might just raise the rent. So the argument is that subsidies without adequate supply just drive up overall housing costs for everyone else while simultaneously excluding the federal deficit.
Okay, so if a housing voucher is designed to provide physical stability, but it comes with all this market friction, how do we provide immediate financial stability?
Well, this brings us to a huge resurgence of an idea that Thomas Paine would instantly recognize.
Direct cash transfer.
Yes. And the evidence base for this is absolutely staggering right now.
Like that summary from Voxdev, they reviewed 115 different studies on unconditional cash transfers in low and middle income countries.
It's incredibly revealing. And let's focus on the why here. Because the old paternalistic assumption was that if you give poor people cash without any strings attached, they will just waste it.
Right. The policy mechanism used to be deeply conditional. Like, you only get aid if you attend job training, or you only use it to buy specific approved foods.
But the data completely dismantles that assumption.
Completely. The overwhelming evidence shows that unconditional direct cash improves household consumption, it improves child health, and it boosts education rates.
When you give families cash, they tend to spend it on the exact things they need to survive and build a foundation.
We saw this vividly with the expanded child tax credit in the U.S. that we mentioned at the start.
Yeah, research from the Washington Center for Equitable Growth showed that families didn't suddenly stop participating in the labor market.
They used the monthly payments for the mundane, essential machinery of daily life. Diapers, groceries, catching up on utility bills.
And if you want to see the reverse mechanism in action, look at the United Kingdom.
Oh, the reports on the UK's two-child benefit cap.
Yes. This policy limits welfare support to a family's first two children.
And the underlying philosophy there was to incentivize work, right? Ensuring families on benefits face the same financial constraints as those supporting themselves solely through employment.
That was the idea. But anti-poverty groups and the UK Poverty Strategy Commission point out the reality. It ignores the exorbitant cost of childcare.
Or the lack of available jobs.
Exactly. You can't incentivize someone into a job that doesn't exist or doesn't pay enough to cover the childcare required to take the job.
So instead of pushing parents into the workforce, the policy mechanically functions as a penalty on the third child.
It has pushed nearly 1.7 million children deeper into severe hardship. It is a prime example of how direct policy levers can either alleviate or dramatically exacerbate poverty.
Yeah. But, you know, I want to highlight the most surprising outcome of cash transfers I found in these reports.
So which one?
It's a study on a program in Flint, Michigan called RX Kids. They gave unconditional cash transfers to expectant mothers and families with infants. And the result wasn't just better nutrition. They saw a measurable statistical decline in infant maltreatment allegations.
That finding is critical because it isolates the mechanism of toxic stress.
Right. Poverty is exhausting.
It is a chronic state of panic. When a parent doesn't know how they will pay for formula or keep the heat on, the stress levels in the household skyrocket.
Which can lead to conflict and neglect.
Exactly. By providing financial stability, you instantly turn down the temperature in that home. Parental stress plummets, and family dynamics actually improve.
I completely see the logic there. But let's talk about the economic trade-offs, because the debate between universal basic income and means-tested aid is fierce right now.
Very fierce.
Like, critics in the Michigan Journal of Economics point out these trade-offs. If we give unconditional cash to everyone, which is what UBI proposes, aren't we just diluting the pool of available funds?
That's the argument, yeah.
Yeah, because a wealthy household doesn't need a $1,000 check. But that same $1,000 could fundamentally alter the trajectory for a family in poverty. Why not just target the money to those who need it most?
And that is the core argument for means testing. It is economically cheaper on paper, and it explicitly targets the most vulnerable.
Right.
But the plumbing of means testing is deeply flawed. It requires immense bureaucracy.
Paperwork, continuous proof of income, asset limits.
Yeah. And more importantly, it creates what economists call a welfare cliff.
Okay, the welfare cliff. Explain the mechanics of that, because it seems entirely counterproductive.
It really is. Imagine you're a single parent receiving housing and childcare subsidies because you earn below a certain threshold.
Okay.
You get offered a 50-cent raise at work. You take it, hoping to get ahead. But that tiny bump in income pushes you over the eligibility line.
Oh, no.
Suddenly, you lose $600 a month in childcare assistance. By taking a raise, you are actually much poorer.
Wow. So means testing effectively disincentivizes earning more.
Exactly. UBI avoids the cliff and the bureaucracy entirely.
But the trade-off is the gargantuan price tag.
Right.
And politically, it is a very tough sell to tax citizens to send recurring checks to millionaires. Not to mention the fears of triggering massive, well, enormous inflation if everyone suddenly has more purchasing power.
Yes, the inflation concern is huge.
So if cash is just a bridge over these gaps, the labor market remains the primary engine for survival.
It does.
What happens when the engine itself is sputtering?
That is exactly what the Economic Policy Institute is getting at in their report. Direct cash might stop a family from drowning this month, but if they're working a full-time job that doesn't cover basic expenses,
then cash transfers are essentially just the government subsidizing a broken labor market.
Right. The EPI argues that the 2025 federal minimum wage in the U.S. is officially a poverty wage.
Because inflation has eroded its purchasing power so severely.
Exactly. Working full-time no longer keeps a worker above the poverty line.
Their proposed fix is fascinating, though. They want to permanently tie the minimum wage to 2/3 of the national median wage.
It removes the political football aspect entirely. As the median wage goes up, the minimum wage automatically adjusts,
ensuring the lowest earners don't get left behind by inflation.
And we don't have to guess if raising the wage floor works. We can look at the UK again.
Oh, right. The analysis in The Guardian.
Yeah, it points out that the UK's minimum wage hikes over recent years have been deemed its most successful economic policy in a generation.
But wait, the traditional economic fear is that aggressively raising the minimum wage forces businesses to lay off workers.
Or pass the costs on to consumers, creating a wage price spiral.
Yeah. Did that happen?
The data shows it largely didn't. By aggressively raising the wage floor, they significantly compressed the wage distribution.
Meaning the gap between the lowest and middle earners shrank.
Exactly. They boosted pay for millions without triggering the colossal job losses that critics had predicted.
And the higher wages actually increased local consumption.
Because low-income workers tend to spend every extra dollar they earn back into the local economy.
However, when we zoom out to the global perspective, the conversation shifts from just tweaking wages to critiquing the entire architecture of the global economy.
Yes, we have to talk about Olivier de Schutter.
The UN Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, he argues that we need to abandon GDP-centered growth entirely.
It's a bold stance. He states that the global economy must prioritize basic human needs over the frivolous desires of the ultra-rich.
De Schutter's argument basically attacks the fundamental math of trickle-down economics, right?
Yes. The traditional model assumes that if the overall GDP grows, everyone benefits.
But De Schutter points out that pursuing endless growth on a finite planet is accelerating climate change.
And the vast majority of that new wealth accrues strictly to the top. So he's advocating for a redistributive model.
Wealth taxes, debt cancellation for developing nations, robust social safety nets.
Arguing that the current system structurally requires an underclass to function.
And that connection between wealth and climate change is crucial, because the climate crisis is rapidly becoming the biggest driver of poverty globally.
Absolutely. We have multiple World Bank reports analyzing countries like Zambia, the Gambia, and the Philippines.
And the key mechanism they focus on is adaptive social protection.
The genius of adaptive social protection isn't just the financial aid itself, it's the trigger mechanism.
Walk us through that.
Okay, think about a farmer in Zambia. They might be doing everything right, slowly building up their assets, but then a 100-year drought hits.
Okay.
In the past, it would take months for international aid to arrive. By the time it did, that farmer had already sold off their livestock and tools just to buy food for the week.
And once you sell the tools you need to make a living, you fall into a poverty trap that takes generations to escape.
Right. You survive the week, but you've destroyed your future earning potential.
So an adaptive social protection system anticipates the shock.
Yes. Before the drought fully devastates the region, satellite data triggers a digital registry.
And cash instantly appears on the farmer's mobile phone.
Exactly. It allows them to buy food without liquidating their livelihood.
It's like, well, think of it like a mechanical shock absorber.
Okay, I like that.
If a job or the labor market is the engine of a family's economy, a climate disaster is a giant pothole that drops the road right out from under them.
Right.
That instant cash transfer is the shock absorber taking the impact, preventing the entire vehicle from breaking apart.
That's a perfect analogy. And the World Bank emphasizes that combining these adaptive digital cash transfers with climate-resilient infrastructure is the only viable mathematical path to turning extreme poverty into a middle-class society by 2040.
Especially in highly vulnerable places like the Philippines?
Yes.
Well, we have covered an enormous amount of ground today.
We really have. We traced the structural philosophy of poverty from Thomas Paine's 1797 Arguments for a Common Inheritance,
all the way to modern digital registries triggering mobile money in Zambia.
We explored the mechanics of the housing supply shortage, the bureaucratic friction of means testing versus unconditional cash,
and how labor markets are attempting to adjust to inflation. And all of this matters to you directly.
Because these underlying philosophies dictate the reality of the society you navigate every single day.
Whether you're voting in a local election, managing a business's payroll, or simply looking at your own tax return.
These ideas shape how your society gathers resources and who they decide is worthy of receiving them.
The rules of the economy are not laws of physics. They're choices.
The debate over whether to treat poverty as a personal failure or a systemic design flaw is a debate about what kind of society we want to construct.
I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. It builds on a piece by Jean Marks about AI economic disruption.
Oh, this is fascinating.
We spent a lot of time today discussing the tension between work-based aid and unconditional cash. Right now, our entire global system ties minimum wages, healthcare, and basic human dignity to formal employment.
The engine is the job.
Exactly. But if artificial intelligence permanently reshapes or even eliminates enormous swaths of the labor market in the coming decades, what happens to those systems?
If the link between human labor and economic survival is severed, the current models completely collapse.
Will the AI revolution force society to finally implement Thomas Paine's 1797 vision?
A universal basic inheritance completely decoupled from traditional work.
We like to think we understand the mechanics of the economy. But as the world changes, the question isn't just how we fix the broken gears of the current system,
but whether we might need to build an entirely new machine.
Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive.